But the title of this talk is actually Culture, Consciousness, and Direct Action. And the goal is to sort of weave these three things together through some sort of me raising some points, some stories, some questions, and then to open it up for a more richer sort of discussion, because I think there's a lot of space for collective exploration. But sort of one way to sort of initially think about culture is as patterns of action and patterns of consciousness. There's no true definition of culture, right? Wherever you look, there's going to be, you know, but that's one way to think about it, is what are the patterns. So if something that you do once in life is not cultural, something that you do as a pattern, right, perhaps. One way to think about sort of direct action is sort of as a window on the culture of anarchists, and as a guide point to the question of how do we build a truly anarchist culture. And that's going to be a big theme in this talk, is sort of like, what would a really anarchist or really liberatory culture look like? Okay? And then consciousness is, I'm going to argue in this talk, is really what our struggle is all about. It's not about, the state. It's not about capital. It's not about whoever, whatever. It's about consciousness. That's really where the action is. And we'll get into that, for those of you who accuse me of being an idealist. okay. So, first, before we get into looking at these issues, and I'm going to try to get to these issues with some stories, I want to talk a little bit about a definition of liberation, one of my favorite definitions of liberation, that and I'll just give it. And I'd love to hear alternative definitions, you know, when we get into discussion. But this liberation definition is what I'll be using, okay? Liberation means expanding our awareness of the forces that shape our reality and increasing our ability to act on that awareness, okay? Liberation means expanding our awareness of the forces that shape our reality and increasing our ability to act on that awareness. So we see from this definition that liberation is not a state, right? It's not which is sort of like, I guess there's an anarchist joke in there somewhere, right? You know, like, liberation is not a state. Maybe it's a bumper sticker or something, right? It's not the state or whatever. But it's more like a direction or an orientation, right? Or even better yet than a direction or orientation, liberation is a path, right? It's movement in a certain direction, movement along a path. And this makes me think of another saying that touches upon this in the context of what is movement, what are movements. Afterwards, I'd like to hear other people's notions, but there is not a movement, yet there is movement. There is not a revolution, yet there is revolution everywhere. Okay, so the first story I want to give is a story about culture and activity. It's I spent a year in Canton, China in 96 and 97, and Chinese acquaintances of mine would on occasion ask me why I was in China, and I would tell them, well, you know, of course the truth is always more complicated than any single reason that we give for a lot of these things, but the answer I'd give was, well, you know, I'm in China because I want to learn about your culture. People would often come back with me with, well, if you want to learn about Chinese culture, why don't you go to Beijing? Or why don't you go to, you know, where the capital is? Or why don't you go to Xi'an to see the terracotta soldiers? And I'd be like, no, I don't mean that kind of culture. I mean your culture, the way you live, what, you know, how you think. I'm here to engage you, you know? And after, there'd be some confusion, and I'd sort of try to give more explanation, and then oftentimes people would be like, I see what you mean, you know, that kind of culture. And on one occasion, actually, someone told me a special word for that kind of culture in Cantonese. I forget what the word was. I forgot a lot of the words I learned in my year there. But at least one person, after some debate with their friends, figured out that there was a word for that. So, but this kind of experience, you know, clarified for me some of the complexities behind the way, and issues behind the way people in general think about culture, are trained to think about culture, what, you know, what constitutes culture. On the one side, we have sort of museum culture, you know, the official histories culture, you know, the culture that we get taught, you know, when we're, if we're well-educated or cultured people, right? You know, sort of, and it's also the kind of culture that we even find in political theories, right? About, you know, how the world works. On the other hand, on the other side, outside of this museum culture, we have lived culture, the culture of everyday life. And there's actually even a third kind of culture that's probably worth pointing out, which is sort of like culture as quaint sort of ethnic performance, right? Like, so when many whites say, oh, well, whites don't have culture, you know, it's like culture is something that, you know, racialized or ethnic people have, sort of like, you know, this sort of like special little thing that makes you distinctive, right? But if you're, you know, so that's another, a third notion of culture that's interesting. And probably in the discussion, we want to explore sort of this notion of culture and how perhaps it relates or doesn't relate to popular culture versus high culture. Okay. And again, so when I think about culture as how we live in our everyday life, then I'm thinking in terms of patterns of action and thought. Okay. So we'll come back to this whole question. A second story is around white supremacy culture and strategy. Okay. Now, recently I helped organize a conference in LA called Strategic Resistance. And the goal of the conference was to bring together anarchists and anti-authoritarians around the issues of, in their globalization work, anti-globalization work, how to do long-term strategy, how to deal with issues of white supremacy and patriarchy. In one small group discussion that I attended, a white male anarchist said something that struck me. Or actually, what he didn't say is what struck me. He said that anarchists need to deal with white supremacy because it is the glue that holds together the U.S. empire. Okay. Now, on the face of that, that sounds like an interesting, you know, point. You know, whether it's, you know, simplistic or strategically useful, we can leave that aside. But what struck me was that for this white anarchist, dealing with whiteness and race wasn't an integral part of his identity as an anarchist, but rather it was merely a question of strategic value, of what was good strategy for getting rid of the U.S. empire. And so that was kind of, you know, he didn't say dealing with whiteness is an essential aspect of what, you know, liberation means for me, right? He said it's a good tool for dealing with the U.S. empire. So that was kind of, you know, interesting. And I mean, this white anarchist is obviously, you know, sincere in his desire to grapple with whiteness, but still, issues of his culture and race were still secondary in a sense to politics, still backgrounded, and sort of race as a means to an end, you know. And so there's a couple of ironies here. First, the irony of, you know, this kind of move definitely being facilitated by the ways in which whites don't have to think about their own whiteness in any ongoing or fundamental way. But then there's a second irony of an anarchist merely inheriting sort of a common left, sort of Maoist analysis of imperialism and, you know, the notion of the principal contradiction, you know, et cetera. So, I mean, I think there's definitely room for us as anarchists to develop, to really explore truly anarchistic analyses of empire beyond just sort of inheriting, you know, sort of standard left stuff. So I'd like to see some stuff in that direction. Okay. Now, the third story is actually not really a story. One of the things that I found is a lot of people sort of confuse direct action with civil disobedience. With militant civil disobedience. They say, we won't allow any direct actions at our march because we don't want the police to, you know, whatever. And even anarchists make the same mistake, you know, like even people who are anarchists often do that. And I think that at first I was like, God, even in the literature, like if you look at the Earth First Direct Action Manual or the IWW literature, it consistently refers to direct action as protest, as a form of civil disobedience. And there's, you know, some quotes that I could give, but I mean, like, for example, the Earth First Manual refers to a powerful expression of resistance to business as usual, which is not the worst, but they also say technology assisted civil disobedience. Now, most of the people here, I think, have, you know, thought a little bit more about the issue, but just quickly, you know, for me, direct action, I think for a lot of anarchists, direct action really means just people taking the power to make things happen into their own hands without asking or begging those in authority to do it for them, whether legally or illegally, right? So a civil disobedience approach to police brutality might be an orchestrated arrest of community leaders at the police station, right? Whereas a direct action approach to police brutality might be a cop watch, right? And so the CD is not DA. And I was actually, recently I found the Anarchist FAQ, and they have a FAQ on the web. It's a really good resource, which I haven't read the full thing, but there's some good sections that I've seen. And I realized, okay, there's a really good, you know, section on direct action. So I refer people to that FAQ. I just want to give a couple of quotes from a couple of places in that FAQ around direct action. A couple of lines from Voltairine de Clara. Every person who ever thought he had a right to assert and went boldly and asserted it himself, sorry for the archaic pronouns, or jointly with others that shared his convictions was a direct actionist. Every person who had a plan to do anything and went and did it, or who laid his plan before others and won their cooperation to do it with him without going to external authorities to please do the thing for them was a direct actionist. All cooperative experiments are essentially direct action. Okay? Every person who ever in his life had a difference with anyone to settle and went straight to the other persons involved to settle it, either by peaceful plan or otherwise, was a direct actionist. Okay? I think part of the confusion about direct action is many, you know, anarchists historically have also, like, for example, Emma Goldman, a lot of her quotes in the same website refer to civil disobedience consistently, you know. Which, in a sense, you are, if you're being a direct activist or actionist, you are being civil disobedient. You're sort of stepping outside of the bounds.
Is that the FAQ from the ZMAG website?
This is the FAQ. I have the website listed here. This is from InfoShop, I guess. Not InfoShop, but the, I have the website here.
Yeah, you can get to it through InfoShop.
InfoShop, okay, yeah. You can get to it through there. ZMAG has another FAQ?
Very good one.
Okay, cool. Okay. But, you know, I think what's more interesting, though, is like the correct definition of direct action is what direct action is all about. One of the things I think is that direct action, and there's quotes from other anarchists to support this. For example, Murray Bookchin has some excellent quotes in this FAQ, which I just discovered last week. But is that direct action is about self-transformation. It's about people taking their own lives into their own hands. So it's really, direct action is a theory of, contains within it a theory of learning, right? How do people learn, right? And one of the things that I found is like many people who become activists and leftists tend to be, now not all of them are, but tend to be the kind of people who did well in school, right? I mean, I found there's like a disproportionate number, like if you like take 100 activists, you know, a disproportionate number of them are people who, you know, do well with sort of logical, verbal, symbolic manipulation, right? Like, you know, the kind of stuff you do with reading and writing and stuff like that, which is cool stuff, but that's not what consciousness is all about, right? That's just one kind of learning, one kind of consciousness. And that's where direct action comes in to really bridge the gap between sort of like the logical, verbal mentality and the kind of learning that happens through experience, right? Like, I've talked to a lot of people when I'm organizing, and people say, yeah, I agree with you, things are fucked up, but what can you do about it, right? And often that what can you do about it is for people is coming from a space of, fuck, every institution around me, from the workplace to my school to my family to the community to everything, is organized in such a way that this is the only way I think human nature works. A lot of people actually think that human nature is based on exploitation, on the rat race, on oppression, right? Because that's the main experience they've had in their everyday life, right? And so that's where direct action, again, comes in as revolutionary transformation. Helping people through changing their experiences, through experiments, through activities that actually people can feel in their everyday life, show them that human nature is otherwise, right? Show them that their own possibilities are otherwise. Not a lecture, right? Not a talk. Not, oh, comrade, here's the 10 principles if you agree that, you know? It's actually about, you know, shifting our consciousness. And that's why, you know, I just get pissed off when people say, oh, well, you know, the anarchists are just leading with their tactics, you know, when they talk about, you know, direct action is just a tactic. You know, that, you know, it's obviously a vision. It's obviously a philosophy, right? It's obviously a moral principle in terms of what kind of society do we want. And sort of, a question that I want to throw out there for you to think about, and then sort of like, you know, touch upon in the discussion is, let's see, I have a couple questions here. Okay. Supposing that sort of like, you know, direct action is sort of about like people learning for themselves and shifting consciousness through experience. And direct action is also sort of conscious action, right? The difference, like, if you do something by default or by accident or because it's a law, it's not really direct action. It's just sort of like, that's your custom or your habit, right? Like, I tie my shoes when I wake up in the morning. That wouldn't be, you know, that's not what people mean when they say direct action. Even though I am tying my shoe, it's not like I'm like saying, I'm going to tie my shoe because that's the reality that I want to... right? I mean, there's a notion of consciousness somewhere in there, right? When I cough, right, it's not direct action. But if direct action changes our consciousness, well, how about like things that we do out of habit, right? Or things that we do by custom, right? Or laws, you know, fashion codes, social norms. How does that stuff influence our consciousness, right? So our conscious action shifts our consciousness of ourselves and the world. How does default action, things that we do because, oh, well, this is what you do when you go to church, or this is what you do when you're shopping, whatever, how does that impact their consciousness? And that's just something to think about. One question around that, though, is, and this relates to sort of anarchists being against authority, is even if, like, someone, an authoritarian might say, well, you know, if you can change, if the goal is to change our behavior, right, and laws and authority and customs and stuff like that, and can change our behavior, then why even, why, what's the point of, you know, direct action? What's the point of, you know, an anti-authoritarian approach? You know, direct action meaning everyone has the power to change themselves. What's the point if laws can do that, right? Right? Well, for me, like, and I think for many anarchists, the goal is not to sort of like, you know, get people to do the right thing in some laundry list of progressive, you know, social justice and peace or whatever concerns, right? The goal is actually to shift our own sense of our own possibilities as human beings, right? Which is much different than, you know, some laundry list of progressive or even radical concerns, right? Okay. So, and going, let's revisit the China story a little bit. Because I have a couple of questions I want to ask you to think about, and then we'll open up soon for discussion. One is... okay, so we have sort of like two kinds of culture in a sense. We have sort of institutionalized official culture, and we have the culture of individual sort of conscious action that, you know, we can, you know, there's a whole, I mean, that's just sort of like a cartoon sort of like, you know, putting out those two endpoints of the spectrum. On the one hand, we have totally formalized, totally rigid, you know, when the sun rises in the east, this is what you do because it says in the book or whatever, right? And then the other is sort of like, you know, the jokes that you tell to your friends, right? The faces that you make when you're angry at the guy who's driving the car, whatever, right? Right? And, okay, so, but what, like, why does official culture develop? I think that's a critical question for anarchists to ask, right? One of the things that we don't do enough of is say, why do the things develop the way they do? And people sometimes wave their hands and say, and I'm open to hearing, but, you know, oh, well, it's because of capitalism. If we didn't have capitalism, we wouldn't have patriarchy, we wouldn't have racism, we wouldn't have everything, right? Right? That's sort of like the monist, right, focus on capital kind of thing, which we inherited from a lot of Marxist analysis. But actually, I think it's important to look beyond some of these historical analyses. I think they're important, but I think what's more important is to look at social psychological analyses of why patterns develop the way they do, right? Because if we don't understand the social psychology behind the institutions we want to change, how can we change them? If we don't understand what are the human needs and the human sort of desires that are being, you know, negotiated through that institution, being created, being informed, then we can't create alternatives, right? So one way of looking at institutionalized culture, official culture, is as sort of like sort of the strength that comes, or the power that comes from not having to recreate the will, right? So the learning that's done, you write it down in a book, and you make sure the younger generation has it, so that you don't have, they don't have to rediscover all the things that, you know, the previous generations did, right? So at a very fundamental level, that's what institutionalization is about. It's about learning, collective learning, making the learning of everyone available, you know, so not forgetting, in other words, having a memory, right? And so, and all of us, I think, would agree that it's important not to, you know, just, you know, be with, it's important to understand and learn from the past. But how do we develop that kind of memory, institutionalized memory, without sort of authority and status being tied to who's the keeper of the books, right? Who are the elites or the priests that control that knowledge and control that memory, right? And then in a sense of like, you know, in the sort of a cartoon sense, culture is just about momentary action in a moment, what I'm doing now, the way I'm coughing or the way I'm whatever, laughing or the jokes I tell. One of the things that lacks is sort of a sense of like self-consciousness. Like, you know, why is it that, you know, questioning of why is it that I'm doing the things that I do? What does this mean outside of this moment, right? Sort of an awareness of all the forces at play, right? And so there's that tension between sort of, you know, which we find in so many ways, you know, spontaneity and reflection, right? And there's always that, I think that's, it's always going to be there. And at, the more we recognize it, the more we can play with it in a way that is hopefully liberatory. But, so a question that I have from that is, what is the role of culture and oppression, right? And we sort of talked about it a little bit. What is the role of culture and oppression? And what is the role of culture and liberation? Okay. Anarchists in general are really good at talking about culture and oppression, right? You know, sort of the, our sort of knee-jerk anti-nationalism kind of thing. Like, oh, well, you know, whatever, you know, herd mentality, you know? But, you know, but there's other aspects too, right, to think about. And also, obviously, liberation. Now, let's see. How much time have I gone? Because I want to have plenty of time for collective discussion. Okay, cool, thanks. So we've gone about half an hour. There's a couple of more points, and then I want to open it up to... and these points really aren't stories so much as sort of like things to think about in the discussion. People often talk about like in sort of like looking at different, you know, cultural patterns around the world. They talk about like some cultures being more individualistic, others being more collectivistic or whatever. And I always have a problem with that kind of that tool of analysis, you know, like American society is individualistic, right? As I mean, as if Americans aren't like total herd animals when you look at most of our behavior, right? In terms of our consumer habits, etc., our identities. It's so much about following some kind of herd, right? Like we're all like just incredible, you know, autonomous, you know, thinkers and actors, right? Or, you know, Chinese society is totally collective, right? When you look at, like, the way, you know, people, different families deal with, like, status and, you know, they have, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, rat race dynamics even within Chinese culture, right? So, like, that, to me, it's not about, like, individualistic societies versus collectivistic societies, but looking at what kind of individualism gets developed in different cultures and different societies and in different institutions and what kinds of collectivism get developed, right? And in one sense, sort of like perhaps in a, and I'm not a student of Chinese culture. I only lived there for a year. I didn't study anything about it. So other people who you know dealt with it for years can give a more complete analysis. But in a cartoon sense of, you know, just for the sake of this talk, you might say that the basic unit of social action in China is the family, right? And in a cartoon sense, in a similar cartoon sense, you might say that the basic unit of social action in the U.S. is the consumer demographic, right? It's your market niche, right? But still, there's a collective unit of analysis and action, right? People you identify with, who you sort of find, you know, meaning, you know. But that's a cartoon image of both societies. But the point is that there's individuality and collective in different forms. Another thing to touch upon is the role of direct action in creating culture. And to me, this is sort of like actually the critical point of this of you know why we need to think about this stuff is that one of the things that direct action is about people crossing the bounds of convention, of acceptable behavior. Direct action in the sense of people, you know, saying, this is what I want, this is what we want, right? Because it's not just individualistic, it's also collective. And we're gonna move to make it happen. Instead of saying, this is what we want, and there's an established process, a procedure, institutionalized, you know, for us to, whatever, you know, make it happen. And so, like, the question, or one of the things that it thinks about, I think about when I think about crossing the boundaries, is the notion of solidarity, right? It seems to me that anyone who's ever experienced solidarity knows that solidarity is not like some abstract concept that you just sort of like check off on your list of like, you know, principles, but it's actually something that comes through people engaging each other across boundaries of alienation, fear, and that's the only way you can create it. So, let's see. I had a question about that, which is, okay, yeah, a couple of questions and we'll open it up. Okay, what are some of the dangers of oppositional culture, right? Of defining our culture as an oppositional culture. What are some of the problems with that, right? So, like, we are anti that, right? Whatever that is, right? You know. Okay, great. Another question I have is, a story and then sort of see what people think about it. Sort of like selfishness versus altruism. That's another silly duality that it just pisses me off, you know? I mean, how many other people here have been pissed off by that duality? Okay, well, some people haven't, so maybe we should explore it a little bit. But, yeah, right? Like, oh, you know, like the idea is that, you know, like, oh, well, you know, revolutionaries or to be transformative, we have to be altruistic and sort of, you know, martyr ourselves or give ourselves, you know, put other people, whatever. I mean, I don't know, whatever. And that, you know, bad stuff and capitalist culture is about selfishness and ego and whatever, blah, blah, blah. A story that I heard, this woman who did a biography of Mother Teresa, one time she asked Mother Teresa, Mother Teresa, you know, you feed, you know, the hungry, you clothe the unclothed in the streets, you're dealing with people who are very sick on a day-by-day basis. How do you do this every day? And she said, When I'm helping someone, when I look in their face, I see my beloved. It's not a sacrifice, right? So for me, what that story speaks to is it's not about martyrdom or it's not about being altruistic, but it's about having a different kind of self, right? And that's where self-transformation comes in, right? Sort of in consumer society, our self is our pocketbook or our SUV or whatever, right? In other societies, our self might be, you know, whatever, how many, whatever, you know, bulls we've, you know, hunted or who knows what, you know, different notions of self, right? But it's what kind of self we have that is the real issue, not whether you're selfish or unselfish, right? But it's how expansive is your sense of self, right? How can you identify and connect and see how your fate is tied up and connected with the fate of others, right? So that's important, yeah. And there's one other question around heterogeneity versus homogeneity. So if heterogeneity being encountering the other, encountering differences, and the role that has in our own sense of ourself and self-transformation, and homogeneity being around, you know, sameness, and what role that has in our own consciousness. Maybe guys, because I'm from sort of a city, you know, like LA, that for me, and because of my, you know, the sort of boundary crossing kind of work that I've done in my life, which I'm, everyone here I think has done similar work, I tend to celebrate heterogeneity as a sort of like a driving force for consciousness, in the sense that it's sort of like we learn who we are through encountering others, right? That we learn to be critical and reflective on our own selves. On for example, when I went to Brazil, I lived there for a year, and I realized how American I was by being in a context where everyone around me wasn't, you know? And the habits that I had, that are unconscious habits, but that were very distinctive from the way people did it in Brazil, it sort of made me be more reflective on the forces that have shaped me, right? And so I'm really interested in sort of like how, like, we talk about like an anarchist culture, right? On the one hand, we have this sort of cartoon of sort of like, you know, whatever, you know, the punk black bloc, sort of like if you, you know, the fashion archist or whatever, you know. I mean, you know, there's a lot, you know what I'm saying, right? But it's like, it's kind of like, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of like a sort of anarchism as religion, you know, like, you know, with dietary codes and, you know, forms of dress. You know, I mean, there's a room, someone was talking about yesterday, there's room for a full analysis of sort of certain sub scenes or whatever as sort of like, you know, looking in parallel with like religious analysis or, but that doesn't mean that we should throw it all away, right? Because culture is not just about oppression, it's also about liberation, right? But what was I going to say? But if we want to sort of say, well, how can we create a really anarchist society, a really anarchist kind of life, right? Then it seems to me, at least, that we want to figure out ways to help people encounter heterogeneity, right? So that they can be conscious of themselves. Because if everyone around you, for example, if everyone around you is just like you, you never think about why you do the things you do. There's no reason to,